Back when I was young, I decided, wait, back when I was younger, I decided that I would embark on a project to read the entire Bible cover to cover. Start at Genesis and go all the way through to Revelation. Don't skip around, just go all the way through. That would be a really good spiritual exercise for me. And so I started. And every day at night, I would set aside a time to read one chapter. And so I did really good for the first 10 days until I got to Genesis chapter 10. Do you know what Genesis chapter 10 is? Genesis chapter 10 is what's called the begats. It's where so-and-so begat so-and-so, and so-and-so begat, and there's a whole chapter of that. And I thought, this is so boring. And so I said, I'll read it tomorrow. So the next night, I came back to Genesis chapter 10, and the begats were still there. And I turned the page, and I noticed that they went on to chapter 11. And I said, you know what, I'll do this tomorrow night. And I never got past Genesis chapter 10 because those begats were so boring. I couldn't care less who begat who and who was the father and son of who, you know. So that project never made it to completion. A couple years later, back when I was still a lot younger, I decided that I would do a more modest project and I would just read through the New Testament. Begin Matthew 1, go all the way to Revelation, a chapter a day. And so I opened up to the first book in the New Testament, Matthew chapter 1, and lo and behold, do you know what's in Matthew chapter 1? Begats, yes. All about more fathers and sons, and I said, forget it. Maybe God doesn't want me to read the Bible after all. But those begats can be some of the most boring. For most of us, they are the most boring part of the Bible. I mean, who cares about somebody's family tree if you're not in it, right? But this morning, I'm going to preach about the most boring chapter in the Bible. Hopefully, this won't be the most boring sermon you've ever heard. But I'm going to preach on Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 17, on the begats. And this is Jesus' family tree. It's all the people who came before him, all the people who are related to him. And it says as much. It says, Matthew 1, verse 1, it says, a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And then it begins with all the people who are the fathers and the sons. And it goes on and on until you get to verse 17, where it says, thus there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Christ. And then you start the birth story of Jesus. So since we're going into the Advent Christmas season, it seems appropriate to start at the birth of Jesus. There's a guy by the name of Timothy Keller who helped me to see a few things in the genealogy of Jesus that helps make sense of it. And so that's what I want to share with you this morning. Because what looks like just a boring family tree actually has a very important theological purpose. The begats in Matthew chapter 1, historically, basically, they cover the entire period of the Bible, from Abraham to Jesus. And so you basically have many thousands of years of history all covered in this family tree. And what I want to show you this morning is that in that history is really the history of God's grace, which most perfectly was revealed through the coming of Jesus. And so you're going to see that there's more to this genealogy than meets the eye. The first thing I want to show you is that the genealogy of Jesus really is about values. And the genealogy of Jesus really turns the values on the values of this world upside down. God says through this genealogy, my values are the opposite of what the world values. Now, I call this a genealogy, but the fact is it really isn't a genealogy. It's really more like a resume. A resume is what you use to present yourself to the world, to present yourself to a potential employer. It's a way of expressing what your value is and what value you can add to an organization or to a place of employment. Why should they want you? Well, in the old world, in the olden days, people didn't have resumes like we do now, where we list our education and our work experience. In that time, your resume was your genealogy, your family tree. That's what you use to recommend yourself to other people. The family line that you come from, your blood, your stock, that's what you use to recommend yourself to other people and say, I'm a worthwhile person, I have value, I'm a good person, and so on. And so when we read this genealogy, we're really, so to speak, we're reading the resume of Jesus. Now, in our day, we're kind of selective about what we put in our resume, right? Because we want to impress people. So we're selective about what goes in the resume. For example, if we began our education at College A, and after a semester, we flunked out of College A. And then a year later, we started back at College B, and we ended up graduating from College B. Which educational experience is going to go on the resume? College A or College B? That's pretty obvious. College B, College A, it just doesn't get mentioned on the resume. So we're selective about what goes on the resume. Well, the same thing was done with genealogies. You were selective about what went in your genealogy. You didn't put in the worst parts about your family line, about your family tree. For example, we know that King Herod took all kinds of stuff out of his genealogy, out of his family tree, to make himself look like he came from good stock. My wife, Diane, before she had the honor of becoming Mrs. Ray, she was Miss Clay. And the name Clay actually comes from one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, Henry Clay. Now, that's a good thing to have in your family tree, right? Henry Clay, descendant of Henry Clay, one of the founders of our nation. But she also has someone else in her family tree. You may have heard of Jesse James. Now, you tell me, do you think Diane takes more of the traits of Henry Clay or Jesse James? Now, in Jesus' day, you would put Henry Clay in your family tree, but you would take Jesse James out. Okay? You don't put horse traders and thieves and that kind of, you don't put that in your family tree, because this is how you recommend yourself to the world. And what's amazing about Jesus' genealogy, the family tree that Matthew shares with us in Matthew chapter 1, is that Matthew does the exact opposite of what the world would do with their genealogy. The world takes out all the bad characters and just leaves in the good ones. Matthew does the opposite. Matthew puts in all the worst parts of Jesus' family tree. He makes sure those people are included in Jesus' genealogy. Matthew leaves in all the wrong people, so to speak. You didn't do that in that day, yet that's exactly what Matthew does. The genealogy of Jesus turns the world's values upside down. So for example, there are five women who are mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus. Now, that in of itself is highly unusual, because you didn't list women in your family tree. Why? Well, they weren't significant enough to get in there. You didn't count women. I mean, you know the story of Jesus feeding of the 5,000. He probably fed a lot more than 5,000, but you only counted the men. In fact, it says in the story, there were 5,000 men. But there weren't just men present, but that's what you counted. And so the same thing went for the family tree. You only counted the men. Yet, in Jesus' case, women were included. So you might say that there are gender outsiders in Jesus' family tree. Some of the wrong people make it onto Jesus' resume. Furthermore, most of the women who are in Jesus' family tree are Gentiles. Not Jews, but Gentiles. You have Tamar, you have Ruth, and you have Rahab. These were Canaanites and Moabites. Now, Canaanites and Moabites were not allowed into the most holy place of the temple. They had to stay on the outskirts. They were not allowed into the holy place because that's where the presence of God was. And Canaanites and Moabites were not allowed there. Yet who makes it into Jesus' family tree? Canaanite and Moabite women. People who were considered unclean. So you have gender outsiders, you have racial outsiders in Jesus' family tree, but there are also moral outsiders. Jesus comes from some of the most sordid, most immoral incidents that took place in the Bible. I want to share with you Matthew chapter 1, verse 3. If you want to turn there in your Bible, feel free to do so. It says, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Do you know who Judah and Tamar are? Do you know that story? Judah was Tamar's father-in-law. Tamar tricked Judah. She tricked her father-in-law into sleeping with her. So Zerah and Perez were conceived out of incest. They were the children of incest. And incest is against the law of God. So if you're trying to clean up your resume, if you're trying to clean up your genealogy, you don't include people who were born of incest. But that's exactly what you have here in Jesus' family tree. Children who came through incest. And then another one of the women in the genealogy is Rahab. Now, Rahab was a woman who lived in Jericho. And the story goes that she helped the spies who were spying out Jericho. She helped them gain access into the city. So when later on, when Jericho was captured, she was spared. But Rahab was also a prostitute. In fact, she was a Canaanite prostitute. And so again, you know, if you're trying to present a good resume, a good genealogy, you don't put a Canaanite prostitute in. It just doesn't look good. But this is what we have listed in Jesus' family tree. Probably the most interesting one, though, is mentioned in verse 6. In verse 6, it says, "And Jesse, the father of King David." All right, now there is someone who you want in your family tree, King David. Royalty. Everybody wants royalty in their family tree. I mean, if there's one person in the whole history of Israel that you want, King David would be right at the top of the list. You want him in your family tree. But then it goes on to say, David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. So we have a reference now to a woman. And it just identifies her as whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Why doesn't Matthew just give us the name? Why does he say the mother of Uriah's, the mother who had been Uriah's wife? Why doesn't he just say this woman's name? Do you know who he's referring to here? Bathsheba. Why not just say Bathsheba? Why say whose mother had been Uriah's wife? Well, let me just remind you of who Uriah was. Uriah had been one of David's best friends. When David, earlier in his life, was running for his life from King Saul, he ran into the wilderness to hide. And there were a group of men who went into the wilderness with him, and they were called his mighty men. There were 30 of them. These mighty men literally risked their lives to save David's life. They gave everything to save David. And in the names of David's mighty men are listed in 2 Samuel 23. Verse 38 of 2 Samuel 23, it lists them. And I'm not going to read all of them. But when you get down to the end of the list, in verse 39, the last one, it says, "And Uriah the Hittite." Uriah the Hittite was one of David's mighty men, one of David's loyal followers, one of the men who literally put his life on the line for David. And later on, when David became king, David looked at Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. And you're probably familiar with the story of David and Bathsheba. David arranged to have Bathsheba brought to his palace. And he had an adulterous affair with her, and she ended up getting pregnant because of it. And so David got really scared, and he tried to cover the affair up. His attempt at cover-up was unsuccessful. And so out of his desperation to try to cover this thing up, he arranged to have Uriah the Hittite killed. And then after Uriah was killed, David brought Bathsheba to the palace and made her his wife. And later on, Solomon was born. Solomon, who later became king, was born of David and Bathsheba. But let me go back to the question. Why does David leave? Why doesn't David just say Bathsheba? Why does he say the woman who had been the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Maybe he's trying to, take a swipe at Bathsheba. She's not worth mentioning. Not worth giving her the dignity of putting her name there. Maybe that's what it is. Actually, what Matthew is doing here, he's not taking a swipe at Bathsheba. He's taking a swipe at David. By putting that she who had been the wife of Uriah the Hittite, he's reminding every reader, she wasn't just the wife of David, Bathsheba. She's the one who David took immorally and illegally from his good friend, Uriah the Hittite. He's reminding everybody of David's immorality, King David's bad deeds. Now, it had been prophesied that the Messiah would come through the line of David. And so you would fully expect to see David listed in the genealogy of Jesus. And yet, Matthew goes out of his way not to focus on the royalty of David, but to focus on the immorality of David, to make that clear. Now, once again, if you're trying to build a resume, you don't focus on that part. This is totally upside down of how the world would build its resume or its genealogy. And so what we see is that the genealogy of Jesus is full of outsiders. It's full of moral outsiders, cultural outsiders, racial outsiders, gender outsiders. It's full of outsiders. It's the opposite of the way the world would make its resume. And see, the law of Moses excluded all these kinds of people from the presence of God. None of these people were allowed in the temple. Illegitimate children are not allowed in the temple. Canaanites, adulterers, they can't go in the holy part of the temple. And yet, here they are in the genealogy of Jesus. And this is a very important theological statement that Matthew is making. Matthew is saying what Jesus would say, that these are my people. I didn't just come for royalty. I didn't just come for the people who look good on people's resume, the ones you want to be around, the ones you want to be attached to. Jesus says, my people are the other ones too. The ones nobody wants on their resume. The ones nobody wants on their genealogy. The ones are at the very bottom of the racial and the social and the culture and the gender ladder. Jesus says, those are my people too. They're in my family tree. Now, why is this matter? Why is this important? Why would Matthew make this statement? Because in Jesus, your pedigree does not matter. And Matthew is just completely overturning the world's values. The world says what matters is your pedigree. What matters is money. What matters is what people think of you. And Matthew says, no, that's not everything that matters. What's more important than that is that the grace of God covers you. That you are included in the family of God. Wherever you are on the world's ladder, wherever you are in the eyes of the world, you too are a part of the family of God. That you are accepted by God even if you're not accepted by other people. In Jesus, the king and the prostitute are both in need of grace. And in Jesus, the king and the prostitute both receive grace. They're listed in the same family tree. And so the values of Jesus are very different than those of the world. And Jesus comes along and he just turns it all upside down. And he says, what you use to recommend yourself to the world, you don't have to do that in my family. I accept you just as you are, wherever you are. No matter how sordid your past is, no matter what your pedigree is, you're accepted. And this powerful statement is being made in this seemingly boring genealogy. There's something else that the genealogy of Jesus teaches us that we wouldn't easily see. And that is that Jesus is our ultimate rest. Jesus is our ultimate Sabbath. It says in verse 17, Matthew 1, in the very last verse of the genealogy, it says, thus there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Christ. Now you and I read this and we say, okay, that's interesting. 14, 14, 14. Okay, fine. But what are these numbers all about? What are they meant to communicate to us? Are they just numbers? Are they just giving us historical facts? What is this? Why does Matthew tell us there are 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile, and 14 from the exile to the Christ? What Matthew's doing here is he's making a very important theological point, an important truth about God. See, theologically, the number 7 is very important. 7 represents perfection. It represents completion. It also represents rest. We know that God rested on the 7th day and hallowed it, set it apart from all the other days. So the number 7 is extremely important. It's about rest, and it's about completion, and it's about perfection. And in verse 17, it says there were 14 generations from Abraham to David. Well, 14 is 2 sevens. And then it says there are 14 generations from David to the exile. Again, you have 2 sevens. And then 14 generations from the exile to Christ. Again, 2 sevens. So at this point, we have 6 sevens. Are you with me? We have 6 sevens. We need one more 7 to have 7 sevens. The ultimate perfection. The ultimate rest. And what is Matthew saying? Jesus is the 7th 7. Jesus is the completion. He is the perfection. He is the ultimate rest. He is our Sabbath. He's the seventh seven. You know, the book of Leviticus talks about something called the year of Jubilee. The year of Jubilee. What is the year of Jubilee? The year of Jubilee is the seventh seven. Every 7 years, the land was supposed to rest. You weren't supposed to plant crops. On the seventh year, the land would rest. And after seven of those seven-year increments, in other words, at year 49, there was what was called the year of Jubilee. And in the year of Jubilee, the slaves were set free, the debts were forgiven, and everybody enjoyed rest from their labor. The year of Jubilee. And Matthew is saying, Jesus is the Jubilee. He's the one that the Bible, in all of its talking about sevens and rest and perfection, it's all been pointing to Jesus. He's the one who we find our perfect and complete rest in. He's the ultimate Sabbath. He's the ultimate Jubilee. Now, what does it mean that Jesus is your rest, that Jesus is your Sabbath? Well, if Jesus is your rest, one thing it means is that you can stop trying to prove yourself all the time. Where you are on the ladder is important. That matters so much in the world. But in God's eyes, that's not such a big deal. And you can rest from that. Because you don't have to prove yourself to God anymore. There's nothing you can do to recommend yourself to God. God's accepted you before you even had a thought about thinking, what can I do to recommend myself to God? God says, I've already accepted you just as you are. You're my child. And so you can rest from trying to prove yourself to God and to everybody else. And if Jesus is our rest, if Jesus is our ultimate Sabbath, then in spite of all your failures, God's grace covers you. No matter where you've come from, no matter what your background, no matter what your pedigree is, God's grace covers you. And that frees us again from our need to try to earn God's acceptance, trying to prove ourselves to God that we're worthy of Him. And you know, a lot of us need rest just from life and from the troubles of this world. We don't usually think about it in this term, but we really spend a lot of our time trying to control history, trying to control outcomes, trying to control how things are going to happen in the future. We put so much of our effort into that. And we're so afraid that if we don't do things just right, that what's going to happen tomorrow or the day after that is not going to go well. And if Jesus is our rest, we don't have to engage in that exhausting work all the time. Jesus came along and he says, you know, I'm paraphrasing now, but he said, relax, I've overcome the world. You don't have to try to overcome the world yourself. That's not your job. It's my job, and I've already done it, so just relax. And so we can rest in that he's already overcome the world. So where do you go in search of grace? One place we would never think to look is a family tree. It's a genealogy. Boring stuff, right? And yet, the grace of God is so prevalent, it's so overwhelming, that you find grace even in the genealogy of Jesus. That the begats are dripping with grace. And if in the begats there is room for people like Tamar and Rahab and King David, if Jesus claims those people as his family, and won't allow them to be overlooked or taken out of the family tree, then you have a place in his family tree too. He's not going to exclude you either. You're part of Jesus' genealogy too. He's not ashamed of you. And because God's not ashamed of us, because God's already included us in his family tree, we can rest. We can claim Jesus as our seventh seven, as our ultimate perfect Sabbath, and thank him for that.